This episode of Humble Holding Up is brought to you by Luna's Llama Adventures.
So this late in the summer, you've probably been to the river.
Yes.
You've done your backyard barbecues.
Several.
You've maybe gone to some baseball games.
Well.
What is there left to do?
Tell me, Steph.
Well, maybe it's time to think about going on an adventure with a llama or two.
Ooh.
With Luna's Llama Adventures, you can book a llama companion for your next hiking or camping trip and have a cute friend by your side who can also carry your stuff.
You could also book llamas to be a fuzzy fun presence at your party or event. Llama weddings, all the rage this season.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just go to lunaslamaadventures.com. It's the new fuzzy thing to do. It's Humbled Holding Up, the Lost Coast Outpost's second most essential podcast. My name is Andrew Goff.
I'm Stephanie McGarry. What's the first?
Oh, Econews Report.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because they cover important, weighty topics. And here we are. We're just, you know, a couple chuckleheads.
Just a couple of chuckleheads.
But
today.
That's right.
Today, we're going to try to give our.
We're stepping into their territory.
Yes. We're going to give our friends over at Econ News Report a run for their money. Yeah. And attempt to tackle a weighty subject.
Well, kind of. Yeah, a little bit. We're going to talk to Eric Stockwell, who is a kayak guide, Lolita Eric's guide services. And he what he does is people want to go kayaking. They call Eric. They say, take me out on the Eel. Take me on the Van Dusen, take me to Shelter Cove, and he will facilitate such a trip to you. And so we thought, with everything that's going on as it relates to the drought and climate change, you know, he's been making some emotional posts on social media about what he's been seeing out there. And so we thought it might be good to talk to him to get some perspective on the ways that, as I say, drought and climate change are affecting our area.
And specifically our beautiful Eel River.
Yeah.
Which he is spends a lot of time on. So
he's a connoisseur of the eel. So what do you say? What do you say we get Eric in here?
Hi, Eric.
How's it going?
Thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. I had forgotten all about it yesterday. Yesterday I got up at 5 and fished at Shelter Cove with a client all day and finished cleaning gear at midnight.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Well, good morning.
Well, okay. So hope you got a little rest.
Tomorrow I've tried to place days off between my fishing trips because in my 40s I could do 4 days in a row. And I'm like, how did I ever do that? So
yeah,
the days are incredible down there. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, real quick off the top, Eric, why don't you just kind of give a quick summary of who you are and the services you provide?
You bet. I am a local outdoor guide. I take people fishing primarily at Shelter Cove on kayaks, and we're always looking for a salmon. So we fish barbless. I show people different ways to run bait, and we catch lingcod and rockfish, you know, every time anyway. And then the halibut have been really good. I've got halibut on like 11 out of the last 12 trips. And that's a really nice thing to add to the stringer. But ooh, the salmon is the pinnacle. And they fight really well. And when a salmon comes to your kayak, it's not just, you don't just scoop it in the net. It looks at you and it like takes off and avoids your net. And they're like super wily. But another part of my life has always been this surveying of salmon. I volunteer on Humboldt Redwood Company lands. I got access out there about 5 years ago, and it's incredible. It should be a World Heritage site. It's better than any of the parks I've seen. We're down to the last of the Mohicans on the salmon, like 1% of Eel River numbers historic. And it's really tough to watch because I'm not anti-pot, but I feel like our culture being based on marijuana and the fact that we have some conscientious, some outlaw, a bunch of people in between out in the watershed using the creeks and the water, it's ruining what is our potential best legacy here. So that ties me to the river. I track the fish as they come into the river in the fall. They stage up between Fernbridge and Fortuna, like thousands of Chinook. Whether it rains or not, they will go into these crappy little runs. And I'm working with, I'm sending emails to the agencies about, hey, this is a problem. And they're pretty focused on like restoring creek habitat, which is great. They're trying to branch out and do more, but I feel like the main stem of the river has been ignored. We've had pike minnow for 30 years and more that even if they don't eat all the little baby salmon and steelhead as they hatch, they take up all the feeding lanes and eat the food and bully the little salmonids out. So you can't grow up in the Eel River as a salmonid, except if you're hiding out kind of in the fringes.
So you're kind of going in the direction that I was hoping that we would, you know, like one of the reasons we wanted to have you on to talk today is because, you know, as a kayak guide, you spend a lot of time out on our local rivers and living in Lolita, a lot of that time ends up being on the Eel River. And, you know, and this year we're having, you know, this historic drought among other conditions. And you've had, you know, you've had a close up look at these effects. You posted something on Facebook last week that was pretty jarring, that, you know, compared this year's river flow to previous years and other things you were seeing out there. And I was hoping to just kind of, you know, start there on the Eel. Where is the Eel at right now, just as an example of this larger, these larger things that we're experiencing?
Yeah, the drought is bad, but it's super magnified by these issues of water use. And I'm not blaming it on anyone. Our culture has basically failed to put a priority on having water running in the river channel. And like the county is, Hank Seaman in charge of public works is doing this study about groundwater connectivity with surface water. You know, does pumping wells affect the flow of the river? And, you know, how is all this interconnected? And it's very important information, stuff we've always kind of taken for granted. And here we don't even have that many people in this county, and we've sucked the river dry, plus the drought. I mean, the drought definitely is a huge factor, but and the diversion down south is a factor. But I have maintained that no, the all the people on the river that have almost unbridled ability to suck water out of the river has had a huge effect. And I mean, for instance, you hear about people that just pull a water truck up and suck water out of a tributary. Legal or not, that is so damaging. Yeah, I mean, just picture a creek that's barely flowing. Someone sucks 500 gallons of water out, and then that pool just doesn't even really flow out for a while until it kind of catches up. And the animals die. And so our river is dying. And if we don't change the way that we look at the river and the life around it, fundamentally, it's just going to die out, and we're going to be like, oh, wow, our river's dead. What do we do now? So I don't know what the answer is. And I know that we're working towards solutions, and there's some great people doing that, but it's a monolith. it's very slow. And I'm just afraid we're going to lose things before we get the problem fixed.
Yeah, something you did on that post is you posted data of the Eel River's levels for the last 30 years. You had all the data out there, and you know this year is the lowest in that span of time, even lower than, you know, in 2014 when the Eel ran underground for a period. Like, what does that look like when you're out on the river and trying to navigate this thing on a kayak? Like, what do you see that is different? Well,
you know, it's the stats I put up were for that date. And so the river is still flowing, and it's at 70 something CFS at Scotia cubic feet per second. And typically by September, it'll get down around 50. And if it gets below that, we're, you know, an all-time lows kind of territory. And in September, that's not so unusual, but because we haven't gotten substantial rainfall until Thanksgiving the last couple of years, by the time you hit November, you start looking at what's the all-time lowest flow for these dates. And it's like, oh, we usually have gotten rain by then. So it's even more critical if it's 50, 40. I mean, if we don't get rain and it goes down, stops flowing in places, it's already super damaging. The temperature is high. It's, you know, lethal to salmonids. That really varies, subjective, but it's rough. There's all this algae and, you know, there's probably other studies being done about the nutrients that get in the river from all the grows or from whatever other human activity that cause these algae blooms. And, you know, the blue green toxic stuff is showing up earlier in the Trinity. And, right. You got to think twice about even going in the river now. And that's always been the case kind of late in the summer here and there, but now it's like the whole river, watch out. You're going to get swimmer's itch or something worse, probably. How much it's affecting the overall ecosystem and web of life that depends on the river, really hard to say, but it feels really dire, and it's only going to get worse if we don't get some rain. You know, we hardly ever get a real rainfall in the summer, and then we'll see what happens come September. It just seems like, doesn't just seem like the climate change, they're showing that there's this jet stream. I forget the term I heard the other day, but the jet stream has been disrupted by the loss of so much cold, whether it's permafrost or ice sheets in the Arctic, and it's caused this wave disruption in the jet stream so that we have this high pressure that's preventing our storms from hitting. And then it's been super windy along our coast this year, which is great for the upwelling, but it's these high pressure systems that keep us from getting a normal weather pattern. So if that doesn't, you know, it used to be, it was like, oh, we're in a little phase and it will come back to normal. And now it feels like, okay, no, this is the new normal. And what if we don't see storms like we've seen growing up here, you know, for decades, we're in big trouble. And yeah. Ironically, other parts of the country are, you know, have so much water, and these floods in Germany and China, and, you know, we're seeing this stuff around the world. And Humboldt County's version is, we're too dry, the rivers aren't working out. Now, on that note, I don't spend a lot of time on the Mad River, but I know it pretty well. But the big deal about the Mad is you've got Ruth Lake, and then they ship that water down the river to the pumps at Blue Lake.
Right.
So that river ecosystem always has water feeding down it. And Ruth Lake, that valley up in there, is really unique. It fills with water. That aquifer is great. It fills with water again very quickly. And if we had something like that on the Eel that was dedicated to having water coming down the channel, whether it was two pumps or just to have water in the channel of the river, this is a huge river. It should have a certain, it should have a minimum flow. And they talk about that kind of thing in the administration of Potter Valley Project. And I've even spoken to some of the agency people that, you know, do that work. And there's just so much gravity from the money and people down south that it's almost just like a pittance to even be able to talk about it a little bit. But if we don't have some dedication of flow in the river, we won't have a river anymore. And the whole idea that, it'll be better when it rains, that's just not good enough. That, you know, that'd be great if it rained once a month, you know, oh, well, you know. And with marijuana, I thought when it got legalized, oh, Humboldt could be in trouble, you know. Some big company could grow 100,000 acres of it in the valley. Well, apparently people can't figure out how to grow good pot, and Humboldt has this super brand. And I mean, that's good for Humboldt. And I have friends that really do a conscientious job. There's a bunch of outlaws out there too. And when are we going to get to a point where someone does figure it out elsewhere? And then, you know, what's our legacy? Like I put in that post, that weighs heavy on my mind. And the fish, I think of the Wiat people, you know, they're like the river, we call it Wiat. the fish are wiyot, we're wiyot. And I'm like, can I please be a wiyot? This is how I feel. This is what I want in my life. I want these fish. And I think a lot of people want it, but it's a mystery how to get it. You know, it's kind of a, that's our manifest destiny legacy that we just kind of, white people have just trampled the environment, and we're just kind of looking for more. What's our next opportunity? And it's pretty hard to turn around 350 million super comfy resource eaters. You know, that's the big problem. That's the elephant.
Yeah. You'll have to forgive me because my 2-year-old has kept busting in on this
no problem
conversation. So if you've seen me, yeah, like, yeah, she's a curious one, but now I think she's been
enjoy it while you can. Out.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, but I wanted to back up for a second because there's something that I'm curious about, and I feel like I should understand this more. But when you're talking about the water flow measurements, you know, the cubic feet per second, and I don't know how much your understanding of it is either, but how those measurements are taken, like who takes them, and what is the process of that? What does the process of that look like?
That's a good question. I have a couple sites I go to, and U.S. Geological Survey, I believe, is behind that. And it lists all the watersheds in Northern California. And you just kind of drill in to where you want to go. And like the Eel has one at Miranda, a gauging station, Scotia, and then on the Main Fork, Leggett. And so, you know, as a fisherman, you watch that stuff because the river will open to fishing at a certain threshold. Or just as an environmental enthusiast, you know, you look at that like, oh, wow, what did the river get up to from that rain? And just looking at what normal flows are, like if you look at the Klamath gauges, they're base flowed down by Klamath because it's such a big river with regulated water and, you know, this major salmon run, mountainous watershed that isn't being extracted by as many users except in the big projects. The Klamath maybe is at 1,000 CFS at the minimum, I think, down by Klamath, and more like, you know, 2,000 or 3,000. And when the Eel in February of 2019 really puffed up from super rains that we hadn't had in a long time, it hit about 300,000 at Fernbridge. Mm-hmm. And they think in the 64 flood it might have hit 1,000,000 CFS. A cubic foot of water is almost 8 gallons. So even at a really low flow, like 50 cubic feet per second, the Eel's barely running. That's almost 400 gallons a second, 24,000 gallons a minute. It's millions and millions of gallons a day. Yeah. So, you know, well, people taking a few hundred gallons maybe wouldn't matter. Well, there's hundreds of people taking hundreds of gallons. And so, It's just troubling because there's not enough water for the ecosystem and the people both. And, you know, that's a really tough fix because the priority is absolutely with people, you know. And then you've got people that are going with their water truck and pumping out of a creek, and it could be completely illegal. And how hard is that to stop? I've heard so many local anecdotes. Yeah, I've got a friend with property, and they've caught people back in their water truck right down to the creek and sucking 500 gallons out to go sell or to go use on their plants or whatever. And I mean, we don't even know the extent of this problem. So again, if we're going to transition to let's use more groundwater, and we'll figure out in the meantime how much that use of groundwater is affecting the surface water, it's not going to work out if there's still a bunch of outlaws out there taking the in-stream water. And, you know, we're just hoping that a certain rainfall pattern hits that'll be good for the fish to get up and spawn, and that there will be a proper rainfall for the little ones to get out and go grow up in the estuary or, you know, Chinook, go right to the ocean sometimes. But the fish are just like the big iconic indicator that everybody can kind of relate to. There's so much more wildlife that depends on the river flows. What about us? What about people like me that I just want the river in my life because that's part of my spirituality.
Yeah. I think what struck me about, you know, reading your post the other day is just like how emotional, you know, you were about our current situation. And, you know, from what I know of you, like heading out on these rivers is kind of your thing, but you mentioned that the conditions you're seeing are depressing enough that to you that you'll probably be staying off the rivers more, you know, right?
Like, yeah.
Why does this hit you so hard?
Because I do base my spirituality on, I have a degree in anthropology. So that's the lens I see the world through. And we are this species that cooperated to become the master species and with dominion over everything else, pretty much, you know, COVID, here comes COVID slouse. I feel like we've lost sight of this priority on maintaining a balance. And, you know, I want my spirituality to be about acknowledging that importance of that balance and how I want to help. People will be like, oh, you like fish more than people? No, I see that all these things are important to the future of our own species. And for me, that's the ultimate expression of being a human being, is that we got to keep doing the things that gave us this success, and ruining the world is the opposite of what we're supposed to do. It's like our own awareness has led to disaster, catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how ironic. This is, I don't read that much. I'm a pretty smart guy, but I don't read that much. I probably am barfing out all kinds of other people's philosophies, right? I think Freeman House, I read Totem Salmon years ago. And recently I was reading an old, I was reading one of Bob Duran's old articles because he put it up on Facebook, and it referred to Freeman House and Totem Salmon and how Freeman talked in that book about how we have to change the way we fundamentally look at our lives. And I'm like, oh, I've been preaching that shit. I took it from that book and I didn't even know it, you know. That's my motivation, is to bolster my soul and my legacy in this world and amongst our species by trying to do the right thing and send the right messages to our culture and the whole world. Because I left my corporate job and my wife's a teacher, and we've been smart with our home and our, you know, everything. And I have the space to try to chase my ideals. And I very much recognize that. And so many people in the world really don't have any of that space. So they're just participating in consumerism. And so I feel like I'm like a dinosaur. Like, well, I could just go extinct. People that care so much about the environment, because if we can just domesticate the whole world and we have enough food for the workers and the elites, then hey, that's all we need, right?
But you're fighting back. You're pushing back. Do you feel like when you take people out, you know, maybe they don't have the level of appreciation for the natural world that you do? Like, do you see like that moment where it like clicks? You're just like, you're explaining something about how the river works, and you see this moment of realization, like, oh, like this is, I feel like that's something that I get sometimes from reading your post, because I don't have the level of knowledge about it that you do. So it's enlightening.
I appreciate that. I definitely really enjoy trying to not only help people learn about these things, but to inspire people to maybe change the way they look at what we're doing and the way we live and what their priorities really should be about. That's a big motivator for me, trying to inspire people. So people might say, oh, you should do this or you should do this. And I'm like, well, I'm in charge of all that. And I'm stubborn and maybe lazy, or, you know, very self-directed. But my goals are to have some kind of legacy that's meaningful for our species and our culture, but you know, our whole species is how I look at it. And that's the way I'm getting there is messaging. And I get to go out on the landscape and do all this really amazing discovery for myself and then share it. And I learned through the fishing trips over the last two decades that I really enjoyed going out and having an adventure and coming back and sharing the true details of it and how I felt and extracting this reaction from people where they were inspired and pleased. And that's it. The inspiration of inspiring others is really my main motivator, I think. So
yeah. And you know, something else you were talking about in that post that you've been talking about now is just this sort of like attitude shift that needs to happen, or like that people, you were talking a lot about it, you know, it people just being driven by consumerism, and that you know, maybe policymakers and stuff are saying we need to use less water, but that it's just not enough, you know, that people need to have a deeper understanding of why this situation is so dire. I mean, what do you think you know, needs to change? Like, how do you see that shift happening?
That's the $1 billion question. The $1 million question is too cheap anymore. I don't know. I think that I like to come off like that's a bad phrase. I like to represent the best of what I have. I like to give that to people, but I don't have all the answers for sure. I don't know what it's going to take. Sometimes I think it's going to take a major catastrophe. I mean, look at COVID. It's a major catastrophe, and we can barely even get to a point where we agree on what to do about it. And so frustrating. And I don't want to get into the politics, but it's just dominates everything. Like, we are seriously going to bypass logic, common sense, and science because some people are so stubborn. Some of them financially motivated. Others, I feel like, just wanted license to live like an asshole. Yeah. What a theme. Wow. So I, how do you fix it? I don't know. Major catastrophe is kind of feeling like the biggest mechanism that might get us there. And we're on a slow motion track to that right now. And I don't want us to be on a fast motion track, and nobody wants a meteor to hit the planet, but it's answer. Whew. Yeah. Got me.
This episode of Humboldt Holding Up is brought to you by Luna's Llama Adventures. What was that, Andrew?
Oh, I've been working on my llama call. Do you wanna hear it again?
I don't really think.
Not bad, right? I've just been so excited since Luna's Llama's Adventures started booking llama tours, wherein you, the fun, outdoorsy, humbled adventurer, head out into nature with a hearty and fuzzy llama companion. Do you have any llama hike selfies, Steph?
Not yet, Andrew. But that's going to change really soon when I go to lunaslamaadventures.com and book my llama trek.
So the rivers are bumming you out a little bit. So you've been sticking to the oceans more, it looks like. You posted, we talked about you going to Shelter Cove, plenty of water there, but not immune to some of the other effects from climate change. Right. You know, what kind of changes to our recreational ocean conditions have you been seeing in recent years?
Well, the big deal was 2015, 2016, we had a warm water blob that, you know, there's always warm water off the coast. Like, the tuna fishermen are tracking where the warm water break is, and they're going to go out 50 miles from Eureka or 40 miles from Shelter Cove and find the tuna, because these winds that occur along our coastline from, I think, Southern Oregon down toward the Bay Area. It's a unique area in the world that gets these strong winds along the coast, north winds. And those winds push water, and new water doesn't just come in behind it. It comes up. It's like a vacuum effect, right? Something's going to fill in. So that upwelling brings nutrients and cold water. So our coastal water stays nice and cold, and that supports the anchovies and the salmon and everything that likes cold water. Mm-hmm. So when the warm water blob moved in, it related to, I'm sure, the climate change, the disruption in this jet stream pattern, you know, these big high pressure domes, the warm water moved into shore. And I remember coming in from trips those years, and I'll usually, like, you know, it's a long day on the water. I've got all this gear on because we dress for immersion, but we're on top of a kayak. You're hot. You've been working all day. Put my gear away and I'll jump right in the ocean. And back in the day, it's like, or most days still, you know, because we have cold water, I jump right back out. It's cold.
Yeah.
And those years I was jumping in and I'm like, wow, this is like the river. I could just put a mask on and go abalone diving with no wetsuit. Seriously, it was 68 degrees.
Yeah.
At the time, I just thought, oh, this is a weird pattern. Well, lo and behold, it was deadly. It really messed up the kelp. The kelp withered due to it. Urchins loved it and exploded in their populations. And they eat kelp. So do abalone. So the urchins exploded. They eat all the kelp. Kelp's gone. They're crowding out the abalone. An abalone tries to lift up to eat kelp, and the urchins stab it. So it just starves to death. And the urchins can eat everything, including the coral and algae, which is a really hard film on the rocks, like pink stuff, right? Purple.
Mm.
They eat everything. And then urchins can live for about 10 years on seawater, just from the nutrients in the water. So urchins are like the evil alien here to take over the planet, right?
Yeah, so see, this is a dynamic I wasn't aware of, that urchins and abalone are at war.
You know, what's funny is the diving community is like, let's go smash all the urchins. And I'm all for trying to do some about this, but I'm like, hey, leave one urchin by the ab, because here's the symbiotic relationship. When kelp that's broken off of kelp plants, you know, bull kelp can grow 12 inches and more a day.
Okay.
So these leaves of kelp in the current, in the tide, it comes by the abalone. The abalone is trying to grab it and eat it. It sticks to an urchin and they work together. They both get to eat it. Well, when there's so many urchins that crowd out the abs, that's bad. And there's just tons of urchins. So it leads to a thing called an urchin baron. Yeah. And this phenomenon has occurred around the planet, and they've shown that they persist, and it's very difficult for them to go away. They'll eat everything, and it really ruins ecosystems. So that's what led to the closure of the abalone fishery in 2017. 2017 was the last year it was open. And I doubt that it'll open again in my lifetime because of what I just described with the urchins. They're so persistent, and you can't just get rid of them. There are billions of them.
Yeah.
So that's been the big change. And then the ocean goes through varying degrees of productivity largely based on that upwelling. If we get really good upwelling, it'll bring those nutrients. And that's the basis of the food chain for plankton and then krill and all the critters, so that the bait can thrive and then the salmon can thrive. So when juvenile salmon hit the ocean, like they've just hatched, made their way down the river, they hit the ocean. If there's been good upwelling and this nutrient production leading to all the plankton, the krill and the bait, they have a really good chance of survival. And if not, they have a really good chance of just perishing right away. So we've had a bad run of ocean productivity while we've also had bad production maybe in the streams, and the level of animals is really low. Now, what's out there right now, we're catching some fat salmon and the bait is pretty happy. Whatever has survived is doing pretty well. I mean, there's also been this die off of tens of millions of common murres and other seabirds.
Mm.
And we're noticing that out there. Just like on land, we notice, hey, where are all the insects that used to smash against our windshield? You know, I smashed through a little group of something by Rio Dell the other day, and I'm like, whoa, that hasn't happened in a long time. I felt like it was a flashback or something. But
congratulations.
Yeah. I know. It's like, yeah, that was a bad sign.
Yeah.
So that's been the big indicator. Now, the rockfish and the lingcod and the animals that live down on the reef have kind of hung in there. There's an ability to manage those species, and we'll see how long it takes to start affecting those more. They've actually rebuilt stocks on a lot of those fish, and that's kind of the backbone of the sport fishery I take part in along the coast.
Mm.
But like I said, the salmon is the peak of what we're after. And ironically, it's really a big indicator of the health of our overall environment. And that's one of the things I really love about these animals. Why do we teach kids in classrooms by having them raise some little steelhead? And why do we teach them the life cycle of these animals? Because ultimately, they're not just an indicator or a potential opportunity economically and culturally, and for me, spiritually, for a lot of people. It's an indicator of the health of our own environment.
Yeah, there are canaries.
The canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't we embrace that? Well, because we're too busy having a competition over money or who we want to support because of money or license to live like an asshole. Ironically, that's become one of these big themes. And I can't even word it differently. I just feel
You've come up with a pretty good, catch-all phrase.
There's a lot of people that are just so invested in you can't. I'm not going to do what you tell me, and it's a stubbornness that's I guess just rooted in this idea that I am going to be more free than you want to allow me to be.
Yeah, if only we could channel that stubbornness into a love of nature and the rivers, then maybe it could be used for good. So you know. Everything we've been talking about, of course, it's clear that there's a lot of bad news on this front. But do you feel, Eric, like there are also things to be hopeful about? I mean, are there agencies or groups that you have seen doing really valuable work in this field? You know,
Absolutely. You know, I feel like over half of our population, if you want to take the politics percentages, I hope, you know, is on a good track in terms of, I mean, generally awareness is increasing about the problems and, you know, what our legacy should be or how to live your life. And while maybe mass communication and technology have led to people putting up fences and maybe not even talking to a neighbor, we are able to have this big discussion continuously about what's going on. And there's good things about like Facebook and the other social media and all this mass communication is if you can avoid the conflict, there's a lot of community building that goes on there. Mm. So in Lolita here, we were having little break-ins and stuff a few years ago. And some of us were like, hey, we might need neighborhood watch. So we got the county, the sheriff's help, and they sent their coordinator and we had some meetings and I became a captain for 99 homes right around my place. And we got together, made a phone list and kind of agreed to get in touch with each other. And it really helped to suppress these little break-ins and petty theft and, you know, troubling stuff that was occurring. And it felt good. I mean, I talked to neighbors that I hadn't talked to in years. I met neighbors that I had never met that lived by me for years. And it made me realize we need this community-centered activity so badly. And it can't be just, oh, I'm an American. And, well, I'm not from that region. And we need to get together with the people in our town, in our neighborhood, on our street. And it's just tough because we've built in this real easy existence. Like, I don't need to talk to any of them and hey, get off my lawn. You know, don't drive so fast. It's it's such a hard question. I mean, a lot of this stuff, appreciation for the environment, ability to be a good community member, it comes from our parents. So we try to teach our kids the right thing. But there's a lot of people out there who are disadvantaged or kind of not on top of that. And how do you fix that? Wow, such a challenge. So I am definitely hopeful. As far as groups that are doing things, I talk about the agencies and I'm not bad mouthing these people. I know so many people that work in the agencies that love the animals and love the environment and want to do things that are what I'm talking about, a legacy for our species and our community and the planet. but our culture overall has not funded or provided a mandate to these agencies to, hey, make that a priority, save that, enhance it, require people to stop doing things that hurt it. That's not happening. And when they, like, when you can no longer take a fish out of the Eel River or keep a salmon, right? 1997 was when that changed. And we never kept our fish out of the river anyway, but, you know, that was a huge tradition around here. And it went to catch and release only because they didn't want to upset the guides. It's like, what a joke. 25 years now, you haven't been able to keep a fish out of this river. So almost that much time, 20 years or so before they really airing publicly some plans about how they're going to restore it. And it turns out the plans to restore it, I feel, are just kind of a pittance. It's like they're going to try to maintain what's still pretty strong here and there. And at the same time, the main channel of the river swings full circle all the way back to our conversation here is just like dying. And we can't even figure out how to fix that. Now, a lot of my friends in the environmental community would probably hate this, but I really feel in my heart that if we don't think about blocking the river and creating some water to put in the river, where else are we going to get it? It's an ideal to restore these native runs. But if you don't have a river flowing, it's not going to work. So unless Humboldt Pot goes belly up and everybody moves away, I mean, come on, that's not going to happen. I don't know how we make the river flow without giving it some water. And I'm glad they're going to remove dams on the Klamath. But I think if they removed all the dams, you wouldn't have any of the water for the agriculture. And if we continue to have drought patterns, the fish won't have their water either. So I might be completely ignorant and disillusioned about this, but the heading into the future, we can't look at it through a lens of, well, this is what we've been trying to do, and this is the demands on it. No, there's way more demands, and there's people that want way more than that. So it ties back to the consumerism, which we're all a part of. I'm fully invested in it. I have no way out of it. But like it or not, being an American has evolved into this, I'm going to get as much as I can, and that's my right. And yeah, that's probably the basis of a lot of the stubborn attitude is it's my right to do these things and to have these attitudes and to be as selfish as I want to be. So I think that it's probably very much the case. I don't even leave this country. And I think other countries around the world, my impression is that they look at us like we're real assholes.
That's the word of the day.
Yeah. That's okay.
Well, how is it that you were, you know, drawn to doing this, what you do? I mean, were you exposed to a lot of nature from a young age?
Absolutely. My dad totally taught me about salmon from when I was a young kid. And it was always, he was a fly fisherman. And then he was a commercial fisherman in the summers. He was a professor at CR, but he had a dory and he would go catch salmon to supplement his income. And he would take me out in the ocean, salmon fishing on those dories. And I grew to love the ocean, even though I get really seasick on powerboats. I'm good on my kayaks. But I was taught to respect these animals and their life cycle. And I've just carried that over. It's really stuck with me. It just resonates with me. I mean, here's this animal that it forages and then goes to reproduce and literally gives everything and dies just to reproduce. And that's such a simplistic view. People can never be like that. We don't want to be like that. Or do we?
I don't know. Steph?
I'm not fatalist, but ironically, in a way, the way we're living is the ultimate fatalism. You know, it's like, well, I'm just going to get mine until the world blows up.
Yeah.
And the other end of the spectrum, I mean, maybe some people look at it like, hey, why are you wasting your time? The sun's going to burn out in 14 billion years or something, right?
yeah, which is coming up.
Now we're going to space. The rich guys are getting us to space. So, you know, we'll probably set up some billboards up there and stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's the new solution. We're just going
to call us
the moon. And you know, we... I realize it's probably a bummer year for like newbies to find a passion for kayaking. But if someone wanted to get out there, you know, for the first time, how would you walk them through that?
You know, it's always a good year for kayaking because I mean, like the lagoons, great place, the ocean. The big deal of going to the ocean is if you get seasick, it's going to ruin your day. So you got to be sure about that. But no, there's plenty of opportunities out there. I'm easy to find. If you Google Lolita Eric, you can check out some of my stuff. I basically just market myself through my media. I have a whole bunch of YouTube videos. Most of them are old. I do a lot on Facebook. But I'm totally open to taking whoever is interested in finding out anything about the outdoors. I've led some hikes. I get people inquiring and I always try to come up with whether we can go do something together. And it's not always a fit, but I just, my hope for anyone is that they are able to use the outdoors to discover not just more about what's happening in their own ecosystem, but you find out a lot about yourself out there. And you know what I say about going out on the ocean, we're learning a lot about how we can live better in our terrestrial lives with what we do out on the water. And hopefully we don't get eaten by a shark.
Yeah. I was going to say, I realized that, you know, this might not be the best ad for what you're doing. Is we're talking about all these, just like, man, it really sucks this year.
right.
But I guess it's at the same time, it's good to go and recognize just exactly the state of things. And so you can better know your place in it.
For sure. And I feel like I'm not a cynic. I'm just a realist. And I do try to really focus on finding the half full part, controlling the things I can control and letting go of what I can't. Just trying to understand it. But even the most positive people, I think, are having a reckoning with, we have these looming crises politically, mm-hmm. socially, and environmentally, especially. And I think that generations and generations of people have just kind of dealt with the bigger problems in the background and, you know, living our lives as individuals is natural to us, where maybe if you look at us in a more simple view of, you know, we're animals that we're in small groups working together and that got us here. And if we can try to go back that direction somehow, maybe that can save us, you know, for lack of a better term. I mean, I feel like that's where we're at. We need to get saved. Yeah. And it's, I don't think that a lot of people understand talking about spirituality being linked to these concepts that are really more science-based, and anthropology does a lot of the explanation. Anthropology is the study of the unique aspects of human beings, linguistics, archaeology, evolution, and culture. And I think that it needs a fifth section because we're the species that is fouling the nest and maybe is going to ruin it and is aware of it. And if maybe we need to study that, what's it going to be called? Assholism?
I'm gonna make you a shirt, Eric, that says "Don't be an asshole." Just Eric's guide service. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could start teaching this course, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, I've had a lot of people comment that they would buy my book, so I figure I'm always working on that.
Yeah, just keep chipping away. Yeah.
I might get tagged for plagiarism though, because like I said, I'm unknowingly regurgitating other people's stuff.
We all do that, right?
Right.
What are your we're getting close to your to time here on this, but I was just going to ask, like, you know, what are some, I know you probably don't want to give away your most special secret spots, but like what are some good places for people to kayak if they are, you know, just unfamiliar with this area?
Sure. I mentioned the lagoons. They're great. Jason with Kayak Trinidad has rentals at Big Lagoon. I think he's going to be on Stone Lagoon too soon. He takes people on Trinidad Bay. He runs a good business. That guy's really finding some success. And he's got some great employees. The rivers, people sometimes get the impression of the river like, oh, it's down, it's low, it's all shallow now. Well, no, the form of the river is there's holes and then a riffle. Yeah. In a run and then another hole. And yeah, the river is lacking good form down near Fortuna where these salmon need to stage up. But for instance, like Rio Del, you can drive down onto the river bar and that eastern side along the Scotia Bluffs and, mm-hmm. you know, the old railroad trestle at Nanning Creek. From Nanning Creek trestle north about half a mile or so, that's the biggest hole on the entire Eel River. And the river could dry up and that hole would still be there. It's about 25 feet deep, but it's huge, super volume. People used to water ski there.
Okay.
That's a great place to go year round. And you can park at the mouth of Nanning Creek and go under that trestle and there's fossils all over that creek. It is so cool.
Wow.
Little cold water and it's flowing. There's no one growing pot up there. They can grow pot in greenhouses all over the place, right?
Right.
So that's a neat spot to go. pardon me, Humboldt Bay, you need to be in touch with the priority of dressing for immersion. It's cold, you can get hypothermia and die. It's also ruled by tides, so it's always, you know, the currents are running, the wind's pushing you around. I take people halibut fishing out there, but the halibut bite hasn't been great on Humboldt Bay this year, and it's otherwise kind of a cold and windy place to go where, you know, birding can be good, but otherwise, you know, might be lacking in opportunities for wildlife and nature interaction. Shelter Cove is magic. The locals down there have it made. I mean, the sun comes out in the afternoon there and they line that cove at low tides and the north wind is blocked. And so you're on this black sand beach that heats up just from being that, you know, shade. And it's just amazing. I highly recommend Shelter Cove. It always trips me out if I meet a Humboldt local that's like, oh, I've never been there. Oh, I've only been there once years ago. It is amazing. Humboldt is an awesome place. And Shelter Cove is one of the true gems. I mean, you got the King Range to the north.
Yeah.
Goes up to 4,000 feet right off the water. I think that's the highest first ridge off the water in the continental United States.
Hmm.
And the King Range is just totally unique. So a hike on the Lost Coast is a great thing. I was talking to someone from another outfit. Oh, what was their name? I'd love to plug them. Shoot. They run hiking trips in Redwood National Park and they take some kayak fishing trips up in Crescent City and Redwood. Anyway, he was saying, well, he was trying to hook me up with a hike that they couldn't do because they were booked. And I ended up having a schedule conflict, but I got to talk to him about it. And he's like, oh yeah, people are wanting these hikes. You should market it. And I'm thinking I really should, because the fishing trips are killing me, but I love it so much. But just getting out to the Redwoods at Rockefeller Forest down by Bull Creek, or, you know, even just go out to Swimmer's Delight, and there's old growth trees right in the campground.
Yeah.
I'm a believer that anything we can do to connect with the outdoors will help us to get closer in touch with the animals that we are. You know, this is our environment. It's not just an afterthought. And that's, I guess, ultimately the thing we have to embrace. And we're just kind of stuck in this mode. I mean, look, all three of us are safely in a shelter right now, sitting on our butts on cushions, you know, yeah. Made ourselves so comfortable without the other side of the coin being, you know, I just had a vision of someone praying and worshiping in my head. And I'm not religious, but it's like, yeah, maybe we need to meditate and be thankful for just the things around us that provide us with just contentedness as being a social animal that is having a successful life. You know, we just need to simplify things a little more. And I mean, easier said than done. I don't know how to get that done. I'm going to drive my V8 truck back down to the cove and $40 worth of gas to go fishing again tomorrow. You know, it's like, yeah. How do you break free? You know,
yeah.
But it starts somewhere. And if these things take generations and generations to change, I guess the scary thought is we've ramped up all of our technology and our ability to do things so much that I think one of the more pessimistic views is, can we rein this in before it all kind of crashes? Right.
Doesn't seem like a given.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it all starts with that awareness and working together and acknowledging the things in each other that inspire.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for jumping in here. I don't know how many I don't know how many Zoom podcasts you have done yet, but
a couple here and there. But you know, I'm kind of hard to pin down.
Yeah. Well, if people want to pin you down, as you said, you can Google Lolita Eric's guide service online, and you will show them corners of Humboldt they may have never seen before.
Yeah. To jump back real quick, you said, I don't want you to give away any of your secrets or anything. Da, 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 and it immediately came to mind, well, if someone hires me, I take them right to it.
Okay. Yeah. So that's ironic, that's, you know? That's the price. The price of admission gets you.
Everybody to wants it spot. For free. I'm like, just open your wallet. Cause I
also want to. Just a slave to capitalism and consumerism. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Thank you so much. So Eric,
thank you guys. This was really a pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Eric Stockwell for joining us today and sharing some of his experience and his perspectives on the state of the Eel River and some of our other rivers and water sources. And I think my biggest takeaway from that was, don't be an asshole.
Yeah, that's the message. But we thank Eric for stepping into the Zoom land, and we thank all of you for listening.
Enjoy those rivers, but be safe and avoid the algae blooms that are already out there.
Don't drink the river.
Yeah, don't drink the river water, which you probably already should be doing. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Bye. So, in closing, again, we here at Humboldt Holding Up implore you, please, just go hiking with a llama in the redwoods, would ya? Like, it's not that often that people take a chance to offer our area a new experience, but that is what the fine folks at Luna's Llama Adventure have done. So, are you hearing me, Steph?
Oh, Andrew, I'm hearing you. This mama loves a llama.
More than Obama in pajamas?
Ooh, I've never seen Obama in pajamas, but I would like to.
We've gone off course. This mama should go to lunaslamaadventures.com and book her mama-friendly llama tour today.
Don't tell me what to do.